Today on Against the Grain. When we think of potentially dangerous and addictive drugs, most of us think about illegal substances like heroin or cocaine. And yet widely prescribed drugs like Xanax, Ritalin, Adderall, and Vicodin are also addictive, but legal in the United States. Historian David Herzberg discusses the artificial distinction that's been created between addictive drugs and medicines, with a key difference being the class and race of the consumers who use them and the partial protections that one group receives and the other does not. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. American society's penchant for addictive drugs and the state's policing of them has been the source of decades of public debate, hand-wringing, and scholarly inquiry, whether on the left and right, whether amongst those who had banned them and those who had made them legal across the board. But missing from most of the discussion is that there are two markets for equally dangerous drugs, one legal and one illegal, with a single yet divided regulatory system, which at its core puts private profits over public health. That's the focus of David Herzberg's White Market Drugs, Big Pharma and the Hidden History of Addiction in America. Herzberg is professor of history and director of the Drugs, Health, and Society program at the University at Buffalo. David, illegal drugs are invariably the focus of any discussion of addiction. Why are medical drugs, what you call white market drugs, a much more significant source of drug addiction in the United States?
The most straightforward answer to that is that there is a large and powerful industry with a kind of an unparalleled distribution and retail network that is selling psychoactive pharmaceutical drugs that just, you know, nothing that's developed on the illicit side can compare to the reach and power of that industry. And the number of people using pharmaceuticals is much larger than the number of people using the illicit substances, the substances that have been criminalized. So you're just talking about a much, much larger phenomenon. And it's not that surprising to find when you have a whole bunch of people using substances that are, you know, they're highly desirable, but they're also bring real risks. And it's not shocking to discover that there are a lot of people who encounter those risks and suffer harm from them.
Well, why is it that these two histories of addiction, so addiction to medical drugs, those categorized as legal, and addiction to illegal drugs, those stories have been kept really pretty separate, not just in public conceptions, even in scholarly works. Why have those two histories been kept so separate? And why do you think that this has caused harm in terms of the larger ramifications for public health?
Let me start by saying it's incredible how insidious this is. You pose the question by saying those that have been categorized as medical versus illegal. And one of the things to remember is they're often the same thing. You know, fentanyl is a medicine. Fentanyl is an illicit drug that is at the heart of a public health overdose crisis. It's the same substance, right? So we're not talking about there are some substances that have been categorized as dangerous and illegal and others, different ones, that are medicines. We're talking about the conditions under which our society allows or even encourages people to access the same set of substances. Now, there are a few substances that are just completely illegal in the U.S. Heroin is one. Quaalude is another. But most of them, the great majority of them, are legal in some circumstances. And so when we lean into this idea that there are things called drugs, which are illegal, and then there are things called medicines, which are legal, this warps the kind of stories we tell about the people who use those drugs, the reasons why they use those drugs, the kinds of benefits and potential harms that come from their use of those drugs. And those stories shape how we collectively respond to the drug use of these different groups of people that we create. So on the one hand, some consumers, we call them patients, and we say that their drug use is therapeutic, and we strongly encourage them to use, let's say ADHD drugs, many of which are amphetamine. And when they use those drugs, we believe that this can be beneficial for them, but we're aware that there are risks. We take all kinds of care to try to make sure that the circumstances in which they use the drugs are the least likely to expose them to those risks. We keep an eye out for their health while they use them. All these ways to make sure that people known as patients who are doing this kind of consuming that we like are taken care of. And the people who sell them those drugs, they make a ton of money. And we look up to them for doing that. They're providing therapeutics. Then there are other people using the same substances who are called, the name changes over time over the last 150 years. Maybe they're dope fiends, maybe they're addicts, maybe they're junkies, whatever you want to call them. They're people who often, as far as I can tell, often using these substances for the same general reasons, to either relieve suffering or to pursue some kind of joy or pleasure. These are actually a little bit harder to distinguish than you might think. And they obviously consume in very different circumstances. There's no one regulating to make sure that what they buy is what the seller says it is. They are punished if they run into troubles with the drug. Obviously, they're stigmatized instead of rewarded for seeking health. And so while these kinds of people do exist, there are people who use illegal drugs out of a self-destructive impulse, and there are people who use medications solely because they desire this thing called health. Those are kind of ideal types that don't capture enormous numbers of people, and the real reasons that they're using drugs, what they're getting out of those drugs. And when we kind of enforce those stories with our policies, we make it dangerous, more dangerous for both groups of people. Okay, so we know this most obviously, and I think there's been the most work on the illegal side. Right now, there are people dying because the drugs they're using are not accurately labeled, right? That they buy something and they think it's Xanax, or they think it's ecstasy, or they think it's heroin, and it's in fact fentanyl. And because they don't know what it is, when they use it, they die. That's a really bad outcome, and it's driving a massive public health crisis in that area. And part of the reason why that happens is that we have bought the story that the people using drugs in that context are doing so for self-destructive reasons. There's no possible benefit they can be getting out of it. They don't deserve protection and care because they're criminals. And the result is a lot of death. On the other hand, on the medical side, I think this side is a little bit less known or obvious, but assuming that everyone on the medical side is nobly pursuing health, that the patient doesn't experience any pleasure from using drugs, solely is taking them because their health requires it or because their doctor told them to, the doctors are kind of dispassionately but empathetically providing care to people just to relieve suffering, pharmaceutical companies are providing doctors because they're kind of private sector centers of innovation that are going to provide the tools that can help people lead better lives. Those assumptions enable things like the 21st century opioid crisis, where the regulators get not caught napping, I think that would be going too far, but maybe they get captured. They're being less vigilant, less skeptical, less likely to think, well, wait a minute, does it really make sense that a drug like an opioid that we've known is potentially addictive for thousands of years, like that really it's just not addictive anymore because this company says so? Everyone is well-intentioned on this in this story. And so the degree of skepticism that is just dumped all over everyone in these other prohibition markets, there isn't often enough of it on that white market side. And the last thing I'll say about this is that one of the reasons we can believe these stories, even though they fly in the face of the facts, right? If we're talking about the same substance, then how can we believe that there's such a dramatically different thing going on in these two different contexts or two different markets? And that's the way it's intersected with social hierarchies in the United States. Most evidently kind of whack you over the head with it when you're a historian looking at this story as race. And the reason why I call them white markets is in part because they're legal, but it's in part because they were designed for and designed to be inhabited by white people, people whose racial status gives to them an assumption of innocence and good intentions. And that racial status enables you to do things like sell OxyContin at the levels that it was sold and in the ways that it was sold in the late 20th, early 21st centuries. And in this way, the very whiteness of the white markets turns out to be a problem for consumers in those markets. And then obviously illicit markets have been attached to a very wide range of racialized groups, not just Black Americans, although most centrally and most damagingly, not just Latinx populations, but also people who were racialized as, you might say, off-white. Like in the early 20th century, talking about the children of Italian immigrants, Irish immigrants, Catholics, Jews, Russian immigrants, who were racialized as kind of a worse version of whiteness. So it's kind of a shifting target, but one of the reasons why these stories about that kind of drug use are so believable is that they build on racial stereotypes, that there's already been an enormous social investment in helping particularly white people to believe those racial stereotypes. So when you add this other thing into the mix, you're already prepared to believe it.
So in other words, you're arguing that, in effect, what seems like two different worlds of addictive medical drugs that someone might be prescribed in a medical setting and addictive non-medical drugs, that they're actually much more twin than we realize, but that they tend to be about access and, of course, punishment, and tend to treat different consumers differently. Is it correct that you're saying that the white market drugs, the medical drugs, that although those patients, those consumers of those drugs have more protections than someone buying a drug that's not deemed medical on an illegal market, that although they get more protections, that the way that drugs are regulated in the United States, that even with that category of drug consumers, there really are still inadequate protections, that by itself has not been enough to protect those users from the dangers of a lot of these substances and the companies that would benefit from promulgating them.
Yeah, you put your finger on it, because it's a slightly complicated point, and that's what academics love to do. It's complicated. This one, I think, is complicated at an understandable level. Let me start by putting this market structure in different terms that might help clarify it, which the division between medicines and drugs, the legal and cultural architecture that said we have these things called medicines, and they're promoted, and these things called drugs, and they're criminalized. This was built in the early 20th century, in the 1900s, 1910s, 1920s. This was the same period of time in which racial segregation as a broad social phenomenon was built in the United States. And one of the ways that I've found it helpful to think about this is that during this period of time, American drug markets were segregated. There was a high-class lane for the customers called patients. This was largely, almost entirely restricted to people who could claim a racial status as white, and they got the Rolls-Royce drug markets with all the bells and whistles and protections. And then others were who had the same set of needs and wants for drugs. It's a basic human kinds of experiences. They were relegated to these lower class markets that were much more dangerous, and they were policed in ways that weren't intended to protect them, but to protect others from them. So that's the setup. It's supposed to benefit the white market customers. It's supposed to benefit patients. And indeed, they did get a lot of benefit. It is safer to buy a pharmaceutically produced, accurately labeled drug than it is to buy something you don't know what it is in a prohibition market. However, that doesn't mean that it always worked well for the people on the white side of this equation. One way to think about it is that everybody pays when you segregate a market like this. Some people pay more. I think it's undeniable that the people targeted by the drug war suffered a wider range of problems over a longer period of time than people in white markets. But the people in white markets paid for this setup too, and they paid for it with that kind of willing suspension of disbelief that regulators could sometimes have when pharmaceutical companies or other kind of people involved in the drug commodity chain on those white markets were able to convince them that, well, you know, addiction is a problem of those people, right? You know who the addicts are, you know who the junkies are. But we're selling these drugs to white middle-class people. We're selling amphetamine to housewives who want to lose a little weight. They are good people. And so all of these problems with drugs, they're problems that other people have. And there have been three major periods in U.S. history since the 1870s when this kind of reasoning, this kind of argument won the day, and pharmaceutical companies were allowed to, you know, go wild selling these products, and their sales shot through the roof, and the result was widespread health crisis of people encountering the kinds of health problems you encounter when you're using drugs in unsafe ways. So the one that we all know about today, because we're still living in the aftermath of it, was the opioid crisis. Then in the middle of the 20th century, from the 1930s through the 1970s, so we're talking about, you know, a 40-year period, just like the opioid crisis of today is going on for so long, this was a long period of time in which sales of sedatives, so like barbiturates or sleeping pills, or benzodiazepines, these are drugs like Librium and Valium and Xanax and Quaalude, and sales of amphetamine for dieting and for PEP. These sales of these things went absolutely wild in the middle of the century, and the result was a real public health crisis of car accidents, of addiction, of fatal overdose. It's really actually the first time that you see that fatal overdose from drugs became a significant enough aspect of life that it starts to show up in national statistics is during that time period. And then the first one was at the turn of the 20th century, so late 1800s, early 20th century. And this was when sales of morphine, heroin, and cocaine really shot up through the roof at the same time as there was a crackdown against smoking opium by Chinese Americans. And so you see that the kind of a logic that, well, the good white people the doctors are prescribing the heroin for, prescribing the cocaine for, they're going to be fine, that allowed this big boom. So even though the system is set up to provide certain privileges to white people, like access to these substances that can be genuinely beneficial, the way that privileged access was built, those racial stereotypes implemented in policy, those ended up being dangerous for the people who were supposed to benefit from them as well. And so it's complicated, because access to these drugs is a social privilege that has been associated with whiteness and having money. Just getting to see a doctor and get a prescription, those historically have taken a certain amount of social privileges. But at the same time, those privileges have exposed you disproportionately to a risk of those drugs being sold unsafely because of the same stereotypes that made it possible for you to buy them in the first place. And this is why, for example, in the 21st century opioid crisis, you first saw opioid addiction really shooting up in really white areas of the country. And that's because, you know, it's famously characterized as deaths of despair, but there's a lot of places with despair. You needed despair plus access to a physician who believed that you weren't susceptible to addiction and was willing to write you a script, right? So you needed both things. You needed the privilege as well.
Historian David Hertzberg is my guest. We're discussing white market drugs, big pharma, and the hidden history of addiction in America. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So as you just said, you look at three major crises associated with medical pharmaceutical addiction. And by doing so, you counter the notion that seems to be widespread that the recent opioid crisis is unprecedented. I wonder if you could start with the first of those crises, which you mentioned in passing, that of opioids in the U.S. in the late 19th century. How did medical opioid use become widespread?
In the late 19th century, there were not a lot of cures for the ills that afflict humans. This was a time before the availability of vaccines for a lot of illnesses. There was just a lot of suffering from living from day to day as a person. And when the Industrial Revolution made it possible to produce products in large volume and make them affordable for a lot of people, and the transportation revolution made it possible to transport them and create this retail infrastructure I was talking about of, you know, pharmacies all across the country, this kind of original miracle drug, morphine, and the hypodermic needle, which had been both morphine had been isolated from the opium poppy and the hypodermic needle had been invented in the 19th century, they made it easily accessible to use this miracle drug that just seemed to eliminate suffering. It seemed to enable sleep. It was, as one prominent physician said, it was God's own medicine. And physicians prescribed it a ton. And particularly in this time, historian David Courtwright has kind of crunched the numbers and done the best that we can do in this context to find out who was using it. And it was primarily prescribed to people of middle age, you know, like in their 40s and 50s. It was just as likely to be a rural person as an urban person, and it was more likely to be a woman than a man, and predominantly access to physicians and prescriptions and things were to white people or people able to claim to be white. So you just had a ton of prescribing because there was a ton of medical need, and there was not as of yet an awareness of the kind of problems that free prescribing could lead to. But there most likely should have been, because at this time there was also a drug panic about smoking opium, which was claimed to be originating in opium dens where Chinese immigrant workers would gather to smoke opium. And, you know, white authorities who had a lot of reasons to engage in racist campaigns against these immigrant communities, they saw these dens as a way that Chinese men were kind of preying on white culture, trying to lure white women into these dens and addict them to smoking opium when they would become what was called at the time like white slaves. White slavery was sex work involving white women. So the idea that opioids could addict was there. It was being shouted from the rooftops as part of these racist campaigns to try to deprive Chinese immigrant workers of citizenship and citizenship rights. But they didn't apply it very quickly, at any rate, to morphine and later heroin. And one of the reasons was that the propensity to use an addictive drug and become addicted, white authorities had kind of associated it with Chinese-ness. Like, literally, Chinese culture was dreamy, and there was some way that this was seen as connected to their use of smoking opium, which, ironically, had been sort of rammed down their throats in a certain regard at gunpoint by the British Empire earlier in the century. The point being that the kind of racialization of ideas about drugs, about who's at risk from them and who can benefit from them, were really there at the moment of origin, the first drug crisis. And you can see that divided logic present right there. And the medical sales of opioids peaked in the 1890s. And it was only slowly clawed back, originally by physician reformers. They said, one, this stuff is dangerous. We need to be careful. If you look at medical journals, late 19th century, you look at speeches by leading physicians, they're all about, hey, fellow doctors, you need to take care. Don't use morphine at the drop of a hat. If you do use it, don't tell the patient what you're giving them, because there's no laws against it. They'll just go and keep buying it from the pharmacy. And also, maybe a little bit less known, is they said, okay, we have addicted all of these people. We need to take care of them. They were innocents who were brought into their pitiable condition because of our mistakes, our ignorance. And so we need to take care of them. And what a lot of them meant by we need to take care of them is we need to keep prescribing them morphine. Many people feared that withdrawal could be fatal. And so they say, you know, this is our obligation now, is to take care of these people who are suffering from this condition by continuing to provide them morphine.
And you just mentioned reformers and the role that they played. And it seems that going through this history, through these three eras of crisis around medical drug addiction, that you have different configurations of key players, reformers being one, obviously the consumers of drugs being another, the doctors who may prescribe it. And then there's the question of the regulators, the regulatory state. At what point did an infrastructure appear to regulate medical drugs, and how did that differ from the other part of the state that was there to regulate drugs that were deemed non-medical or accessed in a non-medical way?
That's a great question. And so there's a period of time in the late 19th, early 20th century, roughly called the Progressive Era, and this is a time of state building. This is a time when there was a reform movement of a bunch of different people who, for their own reasons, very different reasons, decided that industrial capitalism had kind of wrecked the basic structures and social practices that allowed American society to stay healthy and in control, and they needed to regulate industrial capitalism. And one of the parts of industrial capitalism that needed regulating, and as a matter of fact, one of the first places that got this kind of robust regulation, were drug markets, because of the fascination and horror about this state that was coming to be called addiction. And there were two fundamental laws passed at this time that illustrate how wide-ranging the political ideologies of the people who wanted to regulate capitalism might be. One of the laws was the Food and Drug Act of 1906. And this law was intended to make the sale of psychoactive substances safe for consumers. Okay, it wasn't a prohibition law. All the law said was, you can't lie on the label. You have to have an honest label. And it also said that, you know, there are six ingredients or eight ingredients that are so dangerous because they're narcotics, they're potentially addictive, that a label is dishonest if it doesn't say it's on the label. Because what if you just sold something with no label at all? Then you're not lying, so you're fine with the Food and Drug Act. Well, it said, no, if you have an opioid in there, if you have morphine in there, if you have cannabis in there, you have to say that on the label, honestly. And if you think about this, one of the, you know, Harvey W. Wiley, one of the lead reformers in getting this passed, he says, our goal is to make sure the consumer is getting what they think they're getting. So it's a regulation for consumer safety. Then 8 years later, the Harrison Anti-Narcotic Act is passed in 1914. And this is a really complicated and totally fascinating law, but I won't dive into the details on it. I'll just say that this law both criminalized the non-medical sale and possession of opioids and cocaine, and also imposed new regulations on the medical sale and possession of those drugs. This was a policing law. This wasn't equip the consumer with the information they need to make smart choices. This was a law that, with criminal penalties for selling these medicines in a way that didn't meet with a legitimate medical need. What this did is carved out some drug commerce, that medical side, with the licensed physicians and licensed pharmacists and the legitimate medical reason, and it created a legal market for these drugs that was going to be regulated in the name of helping consumers use those drugs safely. And the other side was a prohibition law. It said, if you're not one of those patients, there are no circumstances in which you can use this drug safely. And this instituted these two different responses to what had been a unitary problem, which is the Industrial Revolution, industrial capitalism made these new products available in easy ways, and people weren't equipped to handle those risks. And so, as they did in a lot of areas of American life, the regulators stepped in and they said, okay, we need to, the engines of industrial capitalism are too large for individuals to be able to negotiate on their own. We need to help them by regulating. They did that in a way to protect some and to police others. And the people that they protected on the white market side, that crisis went away. It peaked in the 1890s and it didn't reappear with opioids until like the 1990s. So it was a very successful set of policies. Now on the other side, this prohibition policy targeted primarily at the specific drug heroin. Heroin continued to be a public health crisis up until it was displaced by fentanyl a few years ago. So it was a total failure of a policy from a public health point of view. It was a complete disaster, in fact. This is kind of the first, I guess, the historical laboratory experiment of drug policy. And we remember the drug war policy, and those of us who are critics of drug war policies point out, hey, this really didn't work. As a matter of fact, you know, a century later, we're still dealing with the same problem. It's only gotten worse. But sometimes we don't remember that there is a usable past as well. Like, there were policies that worked to rein in an out-of-control market where consumers were being harmed in the use of drugs like morphine and heroin, so very potentially addictive drugs. You can actually do things other than prohibition that work. And it's the combination of really tightly regulate the people who are making money off the drugs and care for the people who end up running into problems like addiction despite those protections. When you combine those two together, you have a really obvious ingredient that worked. And it didn't just work in that first crisis, it worked in the second crisis, it has worked where it has been applied in the third crisis.
Well, what was the regulatory approach in place at the time of the second period that you describe, when sedatives and stimulants became widespread in the early mid-20th century? And of course, these were the product of the pharmaceuticals industry. These were drugs that were not derived from plants.
Yeah, that's right. And so what had happened is in that, to pass the Food and Drug Act and the Harrison Anti-Narcotic Act, there was a political coalition of, there were kind of the do-gooder, they called themselves progressives at the time, who wanted to regulate big corporations. And there were also the kind of, frankly, white supremacist moral crusaders who were really obsessed with the threat of immigrant masses in the cities and black Americans who were no longer in slavery. And they could come together. They both saw that drugs were dangerous, but for different reasons. And the kind of compromises that they struck, one result of that was that the addiction problem was associated very closely with heroin and with cocaine, those specific drugs. So to the point that heroin in 1924 was literally outlawed by a special act of Congress that said, okay, all the other ones can be used medically, but you know, you can't use heroin medically. The U.S., I mean, not every country has this. Heroin is, you know, it's just an opioid. It's available as a medicine in lots of other places. So what that meant is that the apparatus of control for drugs, both in white markets and prohibition markets, they focused on opioids and cocaine. And so when the pharmaceutical industry found these other drugs that, like cocaine, were a stimulant, that's amphetamine, very similar in action to cocaine, and like opioids, was sedating and calming and relaxing and easing of worries, those are the sedatives, they were able to market those with almost no restrictions at all. For the first years, there were no restrictions. As reports that, you know, these drugs can cause problems, they passed laws to make them prescription only. In some ways, this was trying to repeat what they'd done with the Harrison Act, right? To say that, well, you can only possess these if you have a prescription. But it wasn't, because these drugs were not derived from plants and didn't have popular use yet. They were only available to the people who qualified as patients. One wing of the coalition wasn't interested in them. White supremacists didn't really care a lot about amphetamine or sedatives because everybody involved in their use was white. It was white scientists who discovered them and white companies that were selling them to white doctors who were prescribing them to white patients who were buying them from white pharmacists. And they were like, yeah, this is just not an issue that we care about. We're not focused on that. And as a result, the kinds of reforms they were able to pass were pretty toothless. Yeah, you needed a prescription, but once you had a prescription, you could refill it as many times as you wanted. Yeah, it was illegal to possess it without a prescription, but who actually enforced that? And what were the actual penalties? Very mild. And so it looked like a reform to prevent overselling these, but it didn't stop the industry from massively overhyping these pills and creating another situation where people with access to the medical system were exposed to the risks of drugs that they weren't really warned about. Neither the doctors prescribing to them nor they themselves were aware of the potential for addiction, overdose, and other kinds of problems.
So how then did the sedative and stimulant markets become relatively controlled by the 1970s, by the time which kind of marks the end of this period of crisis?
Yeah, so this is actually one of the most unique moments from a drug policy history point of view in the whole story, because in the 1960s, a new group of political actors comes on the scene. It's called the Third Wave Consumer Advocates. These are people coming in the wake of, you know, Ralph Nader's expose of the Ford Pinto's tendency to explode, and a whole bunch of people in the John F. Kennedy administration who are looking at and saying, we have empowered these corporations, but the corporations seem to be pursuing profit in ways that sometimes is harming their consumers. And there was this move to build new state power to regulate corporations, which had really been, you know, in the 1950s, it was what's good for business is what's good for the U.S. There was this new spirit of, well, maybe just the untrammeled pursuit of profit, maybe that's a little dangerous. And so this provided a new set of people who might be willing to vote for robust regulation of the drug industry. And especially after Kennedy's assassination, when you had a whole bunch of these kinds of liberals voted in the next Congress, they were able to team up with these medical reformers and pass laws that didn't rely as much on people whose main goal was shoring up racial hierarchies. One result was more intense regulation of the sale of uppers and downers. So this was the invention of the schedule of controlled substances that imposed all sorts of constraints on pharmaceutical companies, on pharmacy chains, on physicians, on the people who were making money from those sales. And it resulted in a dramatic reduction of what I call casual sales of those medicines. They were still available in white markets. And that prevented there from being one of those situations where you just make it illegal and then all the people who've come to rely and depend on it are suddenly freaking out and they need to turn to illegal markets to buy. Well, no, these drugs were still available. What got reduced was casual prescribing that happened without awareness of or concern for the risks. The other half of this law is pretty fascinating. Nixon is famous for launching the war on drugs using that language, and this law eventually became a war on drugs law. But originally, it actually reduced the penalties for a lot of illegal drug transactions, and for the first time since the late 19th century, made it legal to prescribe an opioid to someone who was addicted to opioids. This is methadone. And while the provision of methadone was incredibly hyper-policed and stigmatizing and looked more like a carceral kind of relationship than a health one, it was still a remarkable achievement 70 years after the law said you can only possess and use these drugs if you have a legitimate prescription and it is illegitimate to prescribe to treat addiction. This law is one of the ones that helped make it possible for people with addiction to get access to a long-acting opioid like methadone that could care for their opioid addiction while also making it much easier to lead a regular life because it lasts 24 hours and only costs a few pennies a dose. So that's how these markets were brought under control once again by training the regulatory firepower on the people making profits, not outlawing them, regulating them, and then instituting ways to take care of people who have developed a dependence or an addiction on the substances. And that was really successful. The 1970s, you see drops not just in white market drug sales and use, but drops in emergency room visits, drops in overdose deaths.
David Herzberg is my guest. He's professor of history and the director of the Drugs, Health, and Society Program at the University at Buffalo, author of White Market Drugs, Big Pharma, and the Hidden History of Addiction in America. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, then, bringing things to the most recent crisis of medical drug addiction of, well, not just opioids, but sedatives and stimulants starting in the 1990s. How did the right-wing turn in the United States following the election of Reagan and then beyond reshape drug policies in the social and regulatory environment and political environment and cultural environment in which addictive medical and non-medical drugs were made available, including for opiates?
We left off this story in the 1970s, and big picture, white markets were more robustly regulated. Prohibition markets were made less draconian and punitive. And that depended not just on those congressional factions that I was talking about, but also depended on civil rights activism against racism and by women. So civil rights and feminisms, the civil rights movement. What these had done, it was challenge some of the deep-rooted racial and gendered logics that made the categories of like junkie versus patient make sense. And that kind of political achievement depended on a constellation of players at this time. So you had the consumer advocates, you had the medical reformers, and you had civil rights advocacy along lines of race and gender. All of those were necessary to challenge this remaining system of segregation of drug markets. And what happened in the 1980s is a massive and successful pushback against some of those elements, those political elements that had made it possible. The Reagan era famously was, you know, government is the problem, we're going to deregulate, we're going to unleash the private sector to solve problems that bureaucratic red tape has only made worse. What is he talking about? He's talking about, you know, the FDA. He's talking about DEA oversight of the drug industry, you know, rather than of prohibition markets. And so there were a lot of, there were both practical changes to drug, to pharmaceutical regulations, and a change in like the, if maybe we can call it the morale of, rather than being the, you know, part of the team that saved America from thalidomide and the FDA, you're now part of the problem with the, you know, the people running the government castigating you for people dying because you're making it take too long to get new drugs to the market. So that's one thing. And the other thing is a renewed burst of white supremacist political action. And in the case of this story, that cohered around the panic over crack cocaine in the 1980s and the 1990s. And essentially, some entrepreneur in a prohibition market figured out that you could make a kind of a snack-sized way to sell cocaine in these chunks called rocks that could be smoked for a quick high that would only last a short period of time, pretty intense high as well, and that this was a perfect packaging to sell cocaine, which had begun to make a comeback as a rich white person's drug, sold as a powder, very expensive, relatively upper class use base. You could package it for poor people. And one of the places where this packaging was most successful was in segregated urban communities, and poor and predominantly black and Latinx. And this kind of cheap high, just, you know, a couple of dollars for a rock, was really a successful packaging. And that led, as often as always happens, actually, when you have totally unregulated sales of a potentially addictive substance, you know, they have real risks for consumers, and those risks were seen on full display in the people who were buying crack cocaine. I should point out that the markets were set up in these urban neighborhoods, but it wasn't just the people living in the neighborhoods that were buying from them. Plenty of people, plenty of white folks from the suburbs came in and they went to where the drugs were for sale to buy them and use them as well. And this led to, you know, a legitimate public health crisis. You have a new drug that people aren't familiar with. They're not familiar with its risks, being sold in unsafe ways, led to lots of problems. It's an unregulated market, which means that market competition can get violent. So these communities that were already struggling with racial segregation, with economic deprivation, they now had to deal with unregulated market competition between crack sellers. They had to deal with the consequences of people who developed addictions to crack, and they had to deal with the public response, which was to double, triple, quadruple, quintuple, sextuple down on the drug war, and for the first time, make a real effort to lock massive numbers of people away in jail for transgressing drug laws. And these laws were at their heart was this 100-to-1 disparity, so that to trigger a level of penalties for possession of crack, you needed 1/100th of the level that you would have needed for powder cocaine. So you can have 100 grams of cocaine, you face the same penalties as 1 gram of crack. And because crack markets were located in these segregated black neighborhoods, that meant that the overwhelming number of people who were arrested for crack were black. This very, very highly publicized drug war was kind of reanimated the idea that addiction was a thing that happened to racial minorities, because racial minorities were, their communities were pathological. They're whatever racist thing you want to say. They were, matriarchal. They were uninterested in work. Whatever the racist line was, that was used to explain why there were problems with crack addiction in their communities, rather than the kind of more dispassionate view of like, oh, well, this is a new product with high risk profile that people are unfamiliar with and it's unregulated, and you would expect to have a public health crisis come from that. And so that undermined the idea that addiction is something that is just a pretty run-of-the-mill risk for a certain class of products that you need to be worried about for anybody who is going to be using those products. Instead, addiction became this black thing, this racialized thing. And that meant that when these newly empowered, we are the private sector innovators who are going to be solving problems that have bedeviled the country because of overregulation, when one of those pharmaceutical companies comes in and says, hey, we've got OxyContin, it's a private sector solution to the problem of chronic pain, which is a real problem. And they say, unleash us. And the Reagan administration says, oh, private sector solution, this is great. And we don't need to worry about addiction anyway, because that's a thing that happens to black people, to brown people. And this combination makes it possible for this incredible thing to happen, which is a company to convince regulators that, yeah, if we put a coating on it, an opioid just won't be addictive anymore. It won't be a problem. And that's how the industry kind of slipped out of the cage that had been put in the 1970s, was the loss of power of corporate regulation as a political value, and the kind of resurgence of racism as expressed in that drug war that was launched after the emergence of crack cocaine.
I do want to end by asking you about sort of the implications, because when there are discussions of drugs in the United States, now often that is about drugs that are deemed non-medical and are accessed illegally, the debate tends to be about free markets, so drug legalization, or drug prohibition. And you argue that actually both of them are more similar than they appear, in that they can lead to a similar outcome, which is poorly regulated markets. So I wonder, as we wrap the program up, if you can tell us what you think we can draw as the lessons of this bifurcated history of medical drugs in the United States, with its highly racialized and class-based limiting of access to some groups and not others. What beyond free markets and prohibition do you think is the way forward for highly addictive substances?
It's a great question, and I have my answer of for what my fantasy would be. So both free markets and prohibition look similar in that they don't prioritize consumer well-being, essentially, right? They're designed around almost everyone else's needs than the consumer. And to me, when I look at this history, and I'm looking at a history of efforts to really create a legal, safe market for psychoactive and potentially addictive drugs, I see that there's been one major obstacle to having those policies be successful in the relatively limited and segregated context in which they were applied. And that's the amount of money that you can make selling potentially addictive products. And as I look at it, you know, on an individual level, that's a different question, but on a community level, you don't see a public health crisis related to addictive drugs without there being a enormous profit motive to flood a community with drugs in an unsafe way. So I came to see that from a social point of view, from a political point of view, the problem with drugs is actually not the drugs, it's the profits. That in point of fact, it seems like these products may not be safely compatible with a profit-based way of circulating them and making them available. They're just kind of the perfectly designed thing that will bring out the absolute worst in a capitalist way of distributing goods. You know, I feel like a sewer socialist in the early 20th century. They're like, look, you know, whatever, have your capitalism, but sewers, we can't only have sewers for people who pay for them or we'll all die of cholera. We need to have publicly provided sewers for everyone. And so we're a sewer socialist. I feel a little bit like a psychoactive drug socialist in that I'm saying we could avoid a ton of this harm if we subtracted the profit from the situation, because that's what leads people to sell drugs unsafely in the first place.
David Herzberg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with David Herzberg, author of White Market Drugs, Big Pharma, and the Hidden History of Addiction in America. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.